This program is brought to you by PersonalLifeMedia.com.
From time immemorial, beginning with indigenous councils and ancient wisdom traditions, through the work of Western visionaries such as Plato, Galileo, and quantum physicist David Bohm, mutually participatory dialogue has been seen as the key to evolving and transforming consciousness, evoking a flow of meaning, a Daya flow of logos, meaning, beyond what any one individual can bring through alone. So join us now, as together with you, the active deep listener, we evoke and engage in living dialogues. Welcome to Living Dialogues. I'm your host, Duncan Campbell, and with me for this particular dialogue, I'm truly delighted to have with me as my guest, Seattle Congressman Jay Inslee, whom I'm speaking with here as he's attending the Democratic National Convention in Denver, Colorado. Together with Bracken Hendricks, co-founder of the Apollo Alliance, Jay Inslee is the co-author of a very informative book, Apollo's Fire, subtitled Igniting America's Clean Energy Economy. And that's a very excellent lead-in, I think, now to what we're going to talk about with Jay Inslee, because part of what renewable energy is all about is the limitless abundance of making a new and renewed relationship with the sun, with wind, with biofuels, the energy that's provided by the earth itself, with thermal energy from the earth, with ocean thermal, and so on, all of which have been written about quite brilliantly by our guest Jay Inslee, congressman from Seattle for a number of years, and his co-author Bracken Hendricks, who was co-founder of the Apollo Alliance 5 years ago. And I can highly recommend that book, Apollo's Fire. It was published just a few months ago and has, in my view, the most comprehensive and the most interesting overviews and details, both, of what's happening in the field of new energy, things that are far beyond anything you're ever going to hear on CNN or MSNBC, much less the three major networks, and you're not going to read about them in the New York Times, even, because they just simply don't cover this in a way that is comprehensive. But this is our opportunity for the next 45 minutes with Jay Inslee, the leading proponent of new energy for many years in the Congress, to tell us what's happening with our government, what's happening with the Congress, what kind of legislation is pending, why is it blocked, who's blocking it, what's real, what's not real. So, Jay Inslee, what a great pleasure to have you here.
Hey, appreciate the subject matter.
And so one of the things I thought we might start with, let you just educate the public here in a way that sadly does not happen in our major media, in our cable TV, or in our print media. Let's start with the fact that when a Democratic Congress was elected with just a very narrow tiebreaker kind of situation in the Senate, so it's not filibuster proof, it really is not a Democratic majority in any functional way, and we have a Republican president who uses the veto power now against the Democrats in a way that he did not when he had a Republican Congress and vetoed absolutely nothing, including all of the irresponsible legislation that occurred during that administration. And now we have a situation where in the House, because there's a Democratic majority in the House, people say, well, gee, it's the fault of the Democrats that we're not having any new energy. John McCain has put out attack ads on television calling Obama Dr. No. He is the man who does not want new energy. And then the most outrageous thing I've seen is television ads where John McCain is standing in front of wind turbines as if somehow this is his new energy plan. And so why don't you deconstruct for us what's real and what's phony in all of this media blitz and help us get an insider's view as to what is going on in the Congress? I just saw Ted Turner 2 days ago up in Aspen, and he said, when I resigned from the board of Time Warner, I said, my advice is simple. You've got to stop doing the dumb things and start doing the smart things. And it's the same with our politics. We've got to stop doing the dumb things and start doing the smart things. So tell us, what are the smart things and how come the dumb things are what's happening?
I appreciate that setup. You know, I would like to say that when Democrats were in a small majority that all ills would be fixed, but with the filibuster and the veto, we still got some mountains to climb. I'll tell you what's going on. What's going on is the country, I believe, is just about to really turn over a new leaf and put a president in the White House who's going to stop living our fears and start living our dreams again, and add a few more voices in the Senate that will overcome that rancid filibuster that really has been the stopper, that has been the fly in the ointment, and has been the reason that we have not been able to advance this clean energy agenda. We have in the House, but other than a CAFE standard improvement, which we did force through over Republican objections, we haven't been able to surmount that filibuster. But with Mark Udall and about three or four other friends in the U.S. Senate, we're going to be able to do that. So I am actually very optimistic that when we have a president who really understands the economic virtue and potential of clean energy for creating new jobs in this country, who sees it as an opportunity rather than just a crisis, we're going to really be able to rock and roll in clean energy. Now, that will not be the case, unfortunately, if we make some wrong decisions coming up on Election Day. Elections do have consequences. I'll just give you one example of a consequence. You know, we have made a very, very strong and stalwart attempt to roll back the ill-gotten subsidies that have been given to the oil and gas industry over the last 100 years. And several months ago, we had, on several occasions, a bill that would roll back about $20 billion of ill-gotten subsidies of your tax money that's sprinkled out to the oil and gas industries, which are the last corporations in the world that need help from Uncle Sam right now, and would have reeled those back in and redistributed those benefits to the solar energy companies, to the wind energy companies, to the photovoltaic company, to the lithium-ion battery companies. All of these new entrepreneurs are doing such great jobs creating this new energy future for us. And it went to the Senate. We passed it in the House. Republicans opposed it in the House, but we overcame that because of our majority in the House, went to the Senate, and the Republicans filibustered it. They got their, you know, marching orders from the oil and gas industry, and they almost, not all of them, but about 90% of them voted for a filibuster. And we got 59 votes to break that filibuster. We came within, we needed one more vote to break that filibuster to have a fundamental a turn of the tide in American history on whether we're going to have clean energy or not. And there was one senator who was in Washington, D.C. that day, I'm told, who did not vote, and we didn't get that one vote that really would have started the revolution. And I'm sad to say that one vote was Senator McCain, who was the pivotal vote that allowed the oil and gas industry to continue their dominance in Washington, D.C., and their ill-gotten grabbing onto these tax breaks that are not necessary when we could have really started this clean energy revolution. So elections have consequences. If we've got a Barack Obama in there, we're going to have a president who's going to support this change in our tax code to drive these the small businesses that are developing these new clean energy technologies. He's going to support a renewable energy standard that calls for 15% of our energy from clean renewable sources. He's going to support the R&D we need. And frankly, his opponent, Senator McCain, has been AWOL on those subjects in the Senate and has joined these filibusters, in fact, when, in voting against these measures. But I believe that the country is now ready to move forward, and I can't think of a better way to do it. So I'm looking forward to this November.
One of the things that I was talking about with your wife in advance of this particular conversation, Jay, your wonderful wife, Trudy, was that she said, when you see these ads with John McCain with a wind turbine in the background, it drives you crazy. And why is that?
Well, my wife is beautiful besides being brilliant, so I agree with both those assessments. And she's listening today, so I hope that gets me some brownie points at home. I got to tell you, my Trudy had to pull me down off the ceiling last week when I was just happened to see this commercial come on showing this beautiful picture of these wind turbines. Turns out it's a campaign commercial for Senator McCain running for president, saying he supports the creation of a new industry. And she literally had to pull me down off the ceiling because he is the guy who stood in the way, stood in the schoolhouse door, if it were, and was AWOL when we needed somebody to break this filibuster. Now, with all due respect, there is no excuse for that whatsoever, and then be running ads with wind turbines. I mean, the only we're going to get some hot air from the Senate on this subject, but we haven't got any votes to break these filibusters. So we need a president that's going to give us some votes and meat rather than just, you know, 30-second ads that distort what's going on here. And I got to tell you, there is a big difference between these two candidates. They each have individual talents. I respect them both individually. But if you want a clean energy future, it is very clear which ticket you're going to punch this time. And it's Barack Obama who has committed and has made several brilliant speeches on these. And maybe it's because he and I agree with this on these matters. But he has really thrown his support on a whole host of these measures to get this job done.
And one of the things I find most frustrating, being someone in the media myself, is knowing what I know and never seeing it brought up on CNN or MSNBC. Of course, it'll never come up on Fox News, and nor does it come up on ABC, you know, Charles Gibson and company there. We saw their performance in the debate, what they're going to be doing if they get in charge of the debate agenda again this fall. None of them actually educate the public to some very basic things. So I want to go through these with you and let you list them off yourself. First of all, you mentioned that these subsidies for the oil industry were ill-gotten. Okay, now, that's interesting because it implies that there wasn't something quite kosher about it. Now, they were voted by our elected representatives and our elected senators. So what we may ask is ill-gotten about them. Well, I happen to read in the back page of the newspaper, maybe on page 27, a very small article that confirmed within the last 2 weeks what I've known for many years, which is that the oil companies are not spending these massive multi-billion dollar subsidies that they've been receiving on drilling for many years. They have, in fact, been spending them on buying back their own stock to increase its value to their executives who have stock option compensation and for their shareholders. And in this particular article that was just 2 weeks ago in the Associated Press, they pointed out that Chevron had spent nine times more on buying back its stock than it did on drilling, that its drilling had not increased at all in the last 10 years, and there were similar figures for Exxon. So what's happening is these taxpayer subsidies, unbeknown to the taxpayers who watch television, who watch CNN, who are eager for news, who want to find out what's really happening, they're not being told that these billions of dollars in tax subsidies are going straight into the pockets of the executives and the shareholders of these oil companies who have not drilled 1 acre of the 68 million acres.
68 million acres that
are already leased. Yeah,
they haven't drilled on.
Yeah,
and the thing that's also troublesome to me is, you know, the thing about these tax breaks, if they were ever justified, they clearly are not justified now. We need tax breaks now that will help the businesses that are creating new technologies for clean, renewable energy sources. The people who need the tax breaks are like the Austria Solar Thermal Energy is going to give us concentrated solar thermal power. The Altaroc company up in Seattle that has enhanced engineered geothermal source. The Enerdel and A123 lithium-ion battery companies that are creating a way to have an electric car. Now, these are the companies that need the tax breaks. But in fact, $21 billion of them are going to the oil and gas folks. And they're turning around and gave more money last year in compensation, in bonuses to their executives, than they, one of these companies at least, than they spent on their entire clean energy research budget. So what they do now is we now see them running these ads talking about how they're the ones, you know, investing in hydrogen and lithium ion. Shoot, they spent more money just on the payroll of their CEO than they did in their entire R&D budget. So we've got to reorient Uncle Sam's direction here and got to help the business people and the scientific community who are really on the cutting edge of technology. We can, and there's a fundamental difference here. We've got to understand that we can't just be looking below our feet for energy. The real infinite source of energy is above our shoulders and between our ears. It's our intellectual capital. It's our creative juices. That is the only infinite source of energy, and it is that source of energy that we have to invest in. That's something that, frankly, the Republicans still don't understand, to my chagrin. It's a thing that Senator McCain has not supported. So when we have some changes in D.C. and we can start reorienting our R&D budgets and our policies, we're going to see tremendous strides. And I'm just so enthused about the great, you know, strides that are being made in technology around this country, you know, many of which I learned about when we wrote this book. I got to know these people around the country who are just doing incredible things. And so I'm excited about it.
Well, there are two or three things to bring up. Those people are really brilliant. We have the greatest innovative minds from around the world that come here to study in our universities and apply for jobs in engineering, who start businesses and so on. But we're losing them. Now they're starting to go back to China. They're starting to go back to India, back to Germany and elsewhere, where those countries are actually making renewable energy a great priority. I think I heard from, who was it? Maybe it was Ted Turner the other night, that China had 25 different solar and wind companies start up last year, and very significant companies, and we had none.
Well, I'll give you an example of what's going on here right now. The Enerdel company is in Indianapolis, Indiana, and they're making a lithium-ion battery, and they have committed, and this is a battery that will power a plug-in hybrid car so that you can plug it in, charge it at night in your garage, just plug it into your plug. Then the next day it'll run 40 miles on all electricity, just zero CO2. It'll cost 1/6 as much as a gasoline-powered car to run. It'll run 40 miles on just electricity. And then if your day's trip is more than 40 miles, and less than half of our trips are that a day in America, then it'll run on gasoline or ethanol the rest of the 200 miles. So you get 100 to 150 miles a gallon effectively on the gasoline you use. So here's a company that on their own nickel and their own venture capital have developed this lithium-ion battery. Well, folks in China wanted them to move, essentially, and there were million-dollar offers made to move their company to China. Now, because of the patriotism, essentially, of these folks in Indiana, that you know they want to stay here. These are the companies that are deserving of America's beneficence and assistance, not the oil and gas folks right now. And that's why we're pushing for this change in our policies. Now, you make an interesting point, too, about how we've benefited by some intellect that's come to this country. You know, I mentioned a couple companies, the Osra company, which does concentrated solar thermal energy. They take mirrors, they concentrate the sun's energy, they heat a fluid in a pipe, they drive a steam turbine, they create steam-driven electricity with zero CO2. They're going to be competitive with coal-based energy in the next decade as far as price. They started from a guy named Vinod Khosla, who grew up in India, moved here, was fundamental in founding Sun Micro Systems, did very well in the internet boom, then moved on to clean energy. Now he has a range of companies, including Osra Energy, that just signed a big contract in Florida and California. Range, which is the first cellulosic ethanol company to be under construction down in Georgia, and a host of other companies. So what we are in America is that we are the world's most creative, innovative society in the history of the planet. Now, that's a pretty bold claim, but I think it's true. And when there are large technological transitions, we do very well, and we need to recognize our ability to do that right here if we have the policies that will create a fair and level playing field for the rest of the upcoming decades. And that's what we need, and I think we're going to get it when the American public speaks this November.
Well, talking about the American public speaking, let's do two things here. We've just talked about how there are many brilliant minds in America, some of them native-born, some of them that come from other countries, drawn by the innovative culture here, the venture capital industry, which has grown up in the last 30 years, which is a unique 21st century tool that has never existed in any other culture and does not exist in any culture right now except the United States. That means people like Vinod Khosla, whom you write about in your book, Apollo's Fire, who know how to identify in the very early stage and are very skilled at making this discernment which technologies are going to survive technologically, you know, which ones have the most bang for the buck, and most importantly, which markets are out there that will accept this technology with the least disturbance to other factors in that market that it has to mesh with in order to get quickly to scale. So this is what these people know how to do. It is a very particular and highly refined skill. I have worked with people like that for over 30 years myself, and I know it's quite an extraordinary skill, and we have the best people and really the only people like that in an organized profession in the venture capital industry in the United States.
Yeah,
and the government is not making use of this whatsoever, and here's the reason why. One reason why, and I want you to address this. I heard from someone who was present at a conference in Denmark 4 years ago, where the head, the chairman, the Republican chairman of the House Committee on Natural Resources, Jim Hansen, was present nearby. And when they were being shown photographs and visuals of the great wind-producing turbines that exist in Denmark, which they have really pioneered, especially offshore, and they now get, I think, 20 or 30% of their energy from wind. They're one of the pioneering countries in the whole world. This man, who's an elected official, Jim Hansen, a Republican, chairman of the Natural Resources Committee in the House, able to block legislation or move legislation forward, he turns to an aide and he says, you know, when the wind is not blowing, do these turbines operate on batteries? Well, this is a comment of such stunning idiocy that it's only matched by the voting public itself, which 2 weeks ago went on record with 63% of the American public saying that they were in favor of offshore oil drilling restrictions being lifted because they were sure that if that happened, their gas prices would go down between here and November. Despite the fact that the first barrel of oil that will come out of any such removal of restrictions would not occur before 7 to 10 years from now, and that the Bush administration has admitted that it will have a negligible, if any, effect on gas prices at all. At full production by 2030, with all of those leases developed that would be released from any restrictions on offshore drilling, we would have another 220,000 barrels a day compared with our 26 million barrels a day consumption today. So we're talking like 1%. It's just extraordinary. And of course, by 2030, we're going to be much more than 26 million barrels a day in terms of consumption, unless we do move to renewables. So you've got, as Ted Turner might put it very bluntly, you have dummies in the Congress and you've got dummies in the population. How do you deal with that?
Well, what I've been trying to do is share by writing this book, and I've been given a bunch of speeches in Congress to try to share the great stories around the country. And all I do is tell stories about brilliant people doing brilliant things, because if folks understand the potential of these new technologies, they understand they're not toys. I'll give you an example. I listened to one of my Republican colleagues the other day. We were debating global warming about what to do about it. And he painted this picture of, if we actually acted to stop global warming, that we would, be living in the Stone Age around, a campfire, breaking rocks and chasing wild animals. And his vision was so distorted and so
ignorant. Let's use the word ignorant.
About the potential. He just doesn't know about all of this good things breaking out. And, I wrote this book a year ago, but even I keep running people doing great things. I'll give you an example. I was at Google in Palo Alto about 2 months ago, and I was talking to Dan Reichert, who is doing some great work at Google, investing in a whole host of these clean energy companies. And he was talking about a company that does what's called engineered geothermal. And that's where you pump water down, you put cold water down, you create a fracture zone because cold water fractures rocks. Then you pump water down, bring it up hot. It comes back at 300 degrees, and you create steam-based electricity. And this has incredible capacity. We could potentially do half of our electricity in the United States if we can make this commercially viable. And it's a technology that's, frankly, not based on rocket science. It just involves perfection of some pumps that can operate in some high pressures and learning how to handle these fracture zones. And he was telling me about this, and I was very impressed about it. And he said, yeah, we just made this big investment in this company called Altarock. And I said, really? And I said, where are they? And he said, well, they're up in Seattle. So here was a company literally in my neighborhood. I live in Seattle, that is a leading company probably in the Western Hemisphere in an industry that potentially could unlock a huge new source of energy for us. And it just came to my attention when I stumbled into Google's investment that they just publicly announced last week. They also have a large investment from Paul Allen and a bunch of other folks. So the point is that when I go around the country, I just keep finding more and more people who are making these discoveries. In our book, we talked about a company called NanoSolar that believed they were going to be able to create a thin cell photovoltaic technology that was going to be able to reduce the price of solar energy significantly because it would decrease the manufacturing cost significantly. And in our book, we talked about their efforts to perfect this, and it was not perfected when our book came out. Well, 2 months ago, the Nano Solar Company in Palo Alto just shipped the first commercial shipment of what's called thin cell photovoltaic. It's a new type of cell that's not based on silicone. It's based on a different material, different metals. And they just made their first commercial shipment in world history. So you have people expressing this pessimism and short-sightedness that don't recognize even what's going on in their own neighborhoods. I'll give you one more example. We were arguing last fall. I was trying to win votes for the renewable energy portfolio that basically would require 15% of our electricity to come from clean, renewable sources in the next 10 to 20 years. And I was talking to one of my colleagues from Florida. I said, hey, we need your vote. You know, this is a great bill. And he says, well, I can't vote for this. I said, why not? He said, well, we don't have renewable energy in Florida. And I said, well, how about solar energy? And he said, well, we don't have solar energy in Florida. And I said, I thought it said the Sunshine State on your license plates. And he said, no, somebody told me, I heard that there's too many clouds, so we can't do solar energy. And I said, geez, I don't think that's the case. And, you know, he wandered away, and I didn't get his vote. Well, 2 weeks, we passed it anyway, though, in the House. 2 weeks after that conversation, this Osra company signed this contract to provide electricity for 250,000 homes in Florida using this brand-new technology of flat-panel concentrated solar mirrors. Now, he was unaware of that, and he was unaware of it because perhaps he hadn't talked to the three-tier company, which is another company in Seattle that has literally mapped. You give the longitude and latitude to this company, and they will tell you exactly what the solar and wind potential is at that longitude and latitude. And that's why the world is beating a path to their doors now, because we're looking for the best wind turbine energy around the world. So my view is the more people understand what is possible, the more people who have their eyes open into the realm of the possible, the better off we'll do, and that's happening. We're getting some folks, even the Republicans are voting for us on occasion, but we need more, and we need them in the Senate, and we need to break these filibusters.
Okay, and that's, I think, the big point here. The big point, the takeaway on the political side that I'm hearing you say, and contradict me if I'm wrong, I might analogize it to John McCain and the pro-life and the pro-choice debate. John McCain is on record as saying that if he is elected president, he will nominate a justice for the Supreme Court who will effectively be the fifth vote necessary to overturn Roe versus Wade. And he's actually made a formal promise that that's what he will do. We all know that John Paul Stevens is 84 years old. He's not likely to last through another administration. So one of the effects that we know will happen if John McCain is elected is that Roe versus Wade will be overturned. So that's just a fact, and he's on record, and he's running on that promise and asking to be elected for that reason. What I hear you saying is that if Barack Obama is elected, one thing that we can count on is that he will not be in a position to veto getting rid of oil subsidies. On the contrary, he will encourage the kind of investments in renewable energy that you and many others feel are necessary to our national security, to our prosperity, to our financial independence, and so on. So is it a safe statement, then, what I'm hearing from you as a professional politician is that if John McCain gets elected, we're going to see the continuation of the kind of veto blockages that a Republican president like George Bush has enacted over and over again to frustrate new energy legislation. But if Barack Obama gets elected, that factor will be removed.
I think that's a very safe bet. And the reason I believe that is that, these two candidates have been through the trial. They've been asked to step up to the mark, and they have been separated on who's going to, vote for clean energy and who's going to vote for a continuation of our addiction to oil. And their records are absolutely diametrically opposed.
So that's very good.
One candidate has voted for renewable energy portfolio standards. He's voted to strip the oil and gas company of these tax breaks and give it to these clean energy companies, many of which I've talked about. He's stepped up to the mark. He bucked the oil and gas company. With all of their enormous financial clout in Washington, D.C., he was there when it was counted, and that was Senator Barack Obama. This hasn't been some rhetorical flourish by him that the polling data shows it's now popular, so he throws up some pictures of windmills on his on his ads. He's the guy that's the real meal deal when it comes to clean energy. Now, his opponent, sad to say, with all his, you know, various charms and the like, Senator McCain, on exactly those same days, was AWOL. It was either missing or action or actually voted with the oil and gas industry and now runs these wind turbine commercials. So, no, these are very different people with different backgrounds and different futures, and the country is now called upon to make that decision. And I got to tell you, I do not want to see this decision dominated by this one industry that, you know, is chained to the past. I want to see us moving forward like we did in the original Apollo project. You know, we understood we had to embrace new technologies when we went to the moon, and we have to understand that if we're going to wean ourselves off of oil, we're going to have to embrace new technologies. This is the only answer, and Uncle Sam has to act to get that job done. We haven't talked a lot about what some of the mechanisms of doing that are. We've just talked about a couple of them, but, you know, there are a lot of things that we have to do to get this job done. We need to have more energy-efficient building codes, for instance. And the Senate has blocked our effort to date. A Republican, a senator, has blocked our efforts to get a more efficient building code so that we don't waste energy. You know, the first fuel, we haven't talked much about this today, but the first fuel and the best fuel and the cheapest fuel and the fastest fuel is almost always energy efficiency. You know, your Colorado genius, Amory Lovins, calls them negawatts. You know, negawatts are the energy don't waste. And we passed in the House a clean energy bill that included a 50% increase in building standards in the next 20 years, backed by the Architectural Association. We're going to take another run at it this September to try to pass that again. And, you know, we may not be able to break a filibuster in the Senate now, but with Mark Udall in the Senate, and four more people who believe in this, we'll be able to do that next February or January.
So that's another critical point I want to make. I want to actually give people now in our last 15 minutes some real clear, crisp understandings based on everything you've said. And one thing I'm saying as a takeaway here is that if there's a Democratic president, President Obama, a lot of this stuff that's been blocked and filibustered and vetoed by the Republicans in favor of continuing the old energy paradigm of aptly named fossil fuels will go away. A huge roadblock will be removed so we can start doing the smart things instead of the dumb things by the simple expedient of having a Democratic president, number one. Number two, if we get four or five more Democratic senators, then the filibuster that the Republicans said they would never use that as a nuclear option. That's why the Gang of Four united, or the Gang of 18, 14, whatever they were, to vote for Alito and Roberts, because they could have filibustered them, but the Democrats decided not to because the Republicans told them that wouldn't be plain fair. And so what did the Democrats do? They didn't filibuster, and now we got Roberts and we got Alito, and there's only one person missing to eliminate Roe versus Wade. So the Democrats dropped the ball when they could have been filibustering, thinking that fair is fair, and when they would be in the majority, that the Republicans would not filibuster. Well, they thought wrong. The Republicans, of course, have used the nuclear option, the filibuster, in order to block sensible energy legislation. So the first thing you're saying is that a Democratic president would remove the veto block, and four or five more Democratic senators, including one from Colorado, Mark Udall, would remove the filibuster block. Now we have to go to some intellectual blocks. One of them is this mythology that somehow new energy is non-competitive. Now, there's two things to be said here. One is the Department of Defense was responsible in partnership effectively with the private industry during the Cold War in creating our entire computer industry. Even people in Silicon Valley today are under the illusion that they did it all themselves in private industry. But in fact, the way it happened was the Department of Defense, because of the threat that was perceived from the Soviet Union and the Cold War, guaranteed the market for these brand new things called silicon microchips. And without that guaranteed market, private risk capital would not have engaged itself in this new technology because it was just too risky. Well, the same thing's happening today, as you're pointing out, with these production tax credits or research R&D tax credits, that there are tax credits that are in place right now for solar and wind that expire this December. And you've been trying in the Congress to get them extended for 5 to 10 years so that private industry will have the assurance that if they fund these solar and wind projects and companies and bring already existing technology to scale, this is what's called the low-hanging fruit, it will immediately be competitive. People like Vinod Khosla, who have spent an entire lifetime identifying good investments, starting good companies that made billions and billions of dollars, not only for the shareholders and the country, but for himself personally. He knows how to do this. And that low-hanging fruit is out there, and he's investing in it. But there could be many more investments like that made if the government would simply extend the tax credits. It's not even giving subsidies like they're doing to oil and gas, but just extend the tax credits so they would, in a sense, guarantee the early stage of the market so these companies could be up and running, and then they take off on their own in the private sector. So the question we've got here from a listener is, what are the best things to invest in now in terms of new energy companies? So my question to you is, what's happening in the market now when we have a president who's committed to the oil and gas, old fossil fuel energy, when we have a candidate who may win the election, a Republican candidate, John McShane, who is also committed to the old energy paradigm, and you've got tax credits that are expiring this December, to extend them is being blocked by the Republicans in the Senate. And so investors, are they investing in solar and wind, or are they sitting on the sidelines waiting to see what's going to happen? And if there is a Democratic president, what will be good things to invest in? And if there's a Republican president, the same. That's the question from the listener.
Well, I think a pretty doggone good investment is electing people to the White House and Congress who are going to help these industries thrive, and I'm serious about that. I mean, in the next 2 months, if people believe in clean energy, the most important thing they do is to, you know, get out and help some candidate get elected who's going to advance these causes, and that's where the game is really being played right now, is at the polling place. So that's the best investment. It's one I'm making to help Barack Obama get elected and Mark Udall and everybody else who believes in this. Technologies, though, you know, there are so many technologies right now, it's difficult to pick, you know, sort of any favorite technology. I think my view, and I think the view of the nation should be, is that we should pick no silver bullet. We should not put our eggs in any one basket. We should take a very prudent investment strategy, which is to spread our investment across multiple technologies. Not all of these technologies are going to work. In fact, some of them are going to fail. That's the nature of innovation. It's the nature of adventure. The Apollo 13, you know, project didn't work. It blew up a tank, came home, didn't make it. We're going to have some of these technologies not work. So we've got to have a broad-based investment strategy to help multiple technologies, and that includes, at least in my book, solar photovoltaic, solar thermal, engineered geothermal, lithium-ion batteries, plug-in hybrid cars, coal technology to try to find a way to sequester carbon dioxide, wave and hydrokinetic energy, new efficiency technologies and heating and cooling standards, new transmission standards, which is incredibly important to be able to improve our transmission grid so that we have a way to distribute and deploy all this energy over a more highly efficient national grid. And I have a bill that will actually create a national superhighway and a high-capacity grid system. So I've mentioned, you know, 10 or 12 technologies. There's 100 more out there. We have to have a very broad-based portfolio and really let the market eventually sort out which are the winners and which are the losers. I will tell you this about those who say renewable energy is too expensive. There's one thing I know for sure. The price of fossil fuel is going up. It's been going up for a long time, and it's going to continue to go up. The cost of these renewables is coming down. There's almost a law that every time we increase the scale of renewable energy by a factor of 10, the price comes down about 20%. So we know that the new technologies are becoming much less expensive. And if we're going to have a plan for our energy future, let's hitch our wagon to those energy sources that are coming down in price, which are clean sources of energy, instead of those that are going up in price, which are fossil fuels. That's a winning strategy. That's a strategy that's going to help grow our economy.
And here I think it's very important to reiterate that the nature of the public-private partnership that took place between the Defense Department and the computer industry in the 50s needs to be repeated for the 21st century with solar and wind and these other technologies, because unless there can be an enactment by the government to guarantee in one form or another through tax credits or outright purchases, as was the case with the DOD, Department of Defense, back in the 50s, there's not enough incentive and there's too much risk for private capital to actually make these investments at this point at the scale that they need to be made at and in the time frame they need to be made at to keep our financial independence, as Boone Pickens has pointed out.
I met with 12 venture capitalists a couple weeks ago in D.C., and basically what they told us is if you build it, we will come. Meaning if you create a demand for these products, we will definitely finance them. So there are several ways that Uncle Sam can do that. One is through a renewable energy portfolio that requires a certain percentage of our electricity to come from clean energy sources. Another are provisions to require more efficiency and less pollution from our cars. Another is the huge procurement authority of the United States. You know, we're an 800-pound gorilla when it comes to buying things. And so Uncle Sam needs to insist that when we buy cars and military equipment, we buy fuel-efficient ones. And that's why I was inserted into the defense authorization bill this year, a provision that requires the Department of Defense to look for energy-efficient products and look at the fuel mileage before they enter into contracts. So, yes, I am confident that, you know, if there's a demand, the American entrepreneur and innovator are going to fill it. It's simply as a matter of creating a demand. And one thing we've not talked about today is probably the single most important provision to create demand for these products is a cap and trade system that will cap the amount of global warming gases going into the atmosphere and require polluting industries to pay to purchase at auction permits to issue pollution. And when we do that, and I feel relatively confident we will do that in 2009 with the right people in office, we'll put a lid, a ceiling on the amount of pollution that can go into the atmosphere. And when we do that, that will drive huge investment into these renewable sources of energy, because now people know they're going to have to be buying, utilities are going to have to be buying clean energy. So probably the mother of all clean energy policies is a cap and trade system, and we're working real hard to develop that right now.
And I might say, as a private citizen here, one thing I've recommended and am recommending to the Obama campaign is that he say, as part of the debates, that he will establish a new energy task force with the best minds in our country, financial, economic, business, military, citizen activists, to take a look at all energy possibilities that we have with nothing off the table. Just take a look at everything we've got, from offshore oil drilling restrictions being removed all the way through to thin film and solar and so on, and have somebody like a Warren Buffett, who's highly respected as an investment mind, look at these with other leading minds, Ted Turner, et cetera, Michael Bloomberg, Eric Schmidt from Google, and determine where is the best bet to get the most bang for our buck in terms of private and public investment in the country, and make recommendations within the first 100 days to the new president. And I think this would be highly effective, and it's a way that ordinary citizens can understand and get behind this, because so far the amount of distortions and deceptions that have been created in false advertising about new energy by the old energy fossil fuel companies has very much confused the public. And if we get respected investment minds like a Warren Buffett saying, I've analyzed these investments in terms of what's the best short-term and long-term return, what's best for, you know, a variety of investment factors, and I come out with X, Y, and Z proposals, then Americans will finally have some real data they can get behind. And you've made a tremendous contribution to this, Jay, by your book, Apollo's Fire. I want to thank you for that and to say it's terrific having you here on the program.
You bet. Thanks for focusing on it. And Duncan, don't forget to vote.
Hey, I would never forget to vote. So thanks once again, Jay Inslee, Seattle Congressman and author of Apollo's Fire. And thanks for being with us. I'm your host, Duncan Campbell, inviting you to be with us again next time on Living Dialogues. And once you have entered your free subscription to the Living Dialogues podcast here on Personal Life Media, future Living Dialogues will automatically be downloaded to your computer on a weekly basis. If you'd like to obtain a CD, MP3, or full transcript of this dialogue or additional dialogues I've done with the many other transformational thinkers listed on my website, livingdialogues.com, you can contact me through that website, livingdialogues.com. That's living, DIALOGUES.com. Thanks again for your deep listening. All the very best.
Find more great shows like this on PersonalLifeMedia.com.